Back together again, you and I, Friday style, wrapping up a big week, October 6, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We started with my thoughts as to what the next step or steps should be in Bridgeport's controversial mayoral election. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep Chris Caruso also weighed in with his weekly political update and thoughts on the absentee ballot mess. Connecticut GOP State Senate Leader Kevin Kelly talked about heating assistance for the needy this winter and a lack of funding, while author Luke Nichter chatted with us about his new book, The Year That Broke Politics, Collusion and Chaos in the Presidential Election of 1968. All right, Friday we are at. Let me get underway with this here production of the show, letting you know the very latest on the Bridgeport absentee ballot situation. Now, some of you folks may have seen the latest in the Hearst, Connecticut media publications today, among them the Connecticut Post. Others, well, you may have not. And let's refer here. Let's get up and underway with a story by Dan Teffer, which says the Secretary of the State, which, of course, would be Stephanie Thomas, she hands over ballots from the Bridgeport primary. So part of Dan Teffer's story reads as follows. The office, the Secretary of the State's office, rather, has turned over the remainder of absentee ballot documents for a hearing coming up next week on the challenge of Democratic mayoral candidate John Gomes' appeal of the results of the September 12th primary. Now, of course, Gomes, who lost that primary to the incumbent mayor Joe Ganim by 251 votes, that is still the official margin in the books, if you will, is suing the town clerk, Charles Clemens Jr., Patricia Howard, the city's Democratic Registrar of Voters, Joe Ganim, and Secretary of the State Stephanie Thomas. Of course, the Gomes campaign is looking for an order declaring Gomes the winner of the primary and placing him on the November ballot or ordering a new primary. Now, William Bloss is Gomes' lawyer. Of course, he was on with Melissa a couple of days ago right here on WICC, Bloss having the judge issue a subpoena for the absentee ballots used in the primary along with the ballot envelopes as well. In one of the complaints filed with the SEEC, the State Elections Enforcement Commission, Gomes and his campaign alleging, again, let's remember, this is all alleged. I know there's video out there on both sides, and people think they know who's in the video. But to really be fair here, understand this is all alleged. Allege that Wanda Jeter Pataki, the vice chair of the Bridgeport Democratic Town Committee, is a woman seen in the videos placing items in the absentee ballot box. So there you go. So again, we're still in the middle of essentially this two-week timeout here as to all sides wanting the material they ask for, the office of the Secretary of the State, Stephanie Thomas, handing over the ballots from the Bridgeport primary. That handover has happened after a complete scanning. It says here, I should have read this the first time around, a complete scanning of five sealed bags. So apparently of the 2,000 and change absentee ballots, they're in five sealed bags containing absentee ballot inner and outer envelopes. So there you go. That goes to the State Elections Enforcement Commission. So we sit and we wait here on this Friday, the 6th of October 2023, and we see how this moves along. And now again, you're getting an even more and more compressed time frame here. Here's a question I want to open with, and we're at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Once again, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. We all know that the incumbent mayor, Joe Ganim, and Mr. Gomes are going to be on the November ballot. That has been established. The Gomes campaign has its footing on another ballot line. if you will. Okay? They have their footing on another ballot line. Does it make sense at this point? Now, I'm not asking this in any way to side with or against the Ganim campaign, with the incumbent mayor, or with or against the Gomes campaign. And Mr. Gomes, one of the challengers here. That's not my issue here. I'm not siding with anybody. But I'm kind of wondering here, at this point, does it make any real sense? Or who is served? Is the city served by doing the primary over? And I understand the initial response from, I'm guessing from most of you would be, yeah, because there is such a thing as doing it right and getting it right. But again, remember, both of these gentlemen's names and their campaigns are going to be on the ballot in November. Let's assume there's a November final election next month and this doesn't get delayed. But at this point, we have video showing the alleged, once again, involvement of both sides here. There have been allegedly identifications of people in both sides here. Both sides are going to be on the November ballot. So, other than the fact that you want to do the right thing, and I'm not sloughing that off at all. Don't get me wrong here. I'm not saying that's not important. But what I am saying is, has the point been made already? And I'm not saying you don't go ahead with any criminal prosecution, whether in the end anybody gets prosecuted or no one gets prosecuted or a few people come up on charges and they're acquitted, whether you're looking at misdemeanors, felonies, what grade of a felony or a misdemeanor, whether you're, you know, looking at something like that. Again, that's not really the issue. The issue is now we know. Well, this problem has been known about for years, right? This is just the aha moment. Well, see, we have the video. And everybody assumed, oh, there it is. It's all again and people. But then we have this round two of video that, that video round two is showing, apparently, the involvement of some of the Gomes people. And some candidates. So, okay, now it covers everybody. Now it's everybody and anybody. Maybe, I don't know. But you tell me, is it necessary to have this primary again? I don't know what the answer is to that. Honestly. Because have we made the point already with the video out there? And is it in the minds of people saying, well, of course, the mayor won. Well, of course, the challenger lost because of funny business. And if we do it again and there's funny business again with the absentee ballots, is that going to really make people, you know, solidified in what they believe about this whole thing? In other words, are we at the point right now where doing the primary over again is, I don't want to say futile, but you see what I'm driving at here? With the money and the cost and the delay, and I know that doing the right thing should not depend on money and cost and delay and staffing. I get that. I understand that. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Should we just... Now, you don't stop the court proceedings. I'm not saying that. But is it just better now at this point? And I'm not saying it is or it isn't. But I would hazard to think that there are a lot of Bridgeport voters who are listening to me right now, no matter who they support, Marilyn Moore, Lamon Daniels, John Gomes, the incumbent mayor Joe Ganim, that would hazard to say, what's the point of redoing the primary? Let's just go on to the general election because both of the primary antagonists, no pun intended, in this lawsuit are on the ballot anyway. And should the effort now be put forward, and I know people want a free and a fair primary situation, I get that, but should the effort be put forward now just to get the general election right? And just to get it right and just to make sure, instead of worrying, maybe, I don't know whether you think about it this way or not, but instead of worrying about, oh, how are we going to jam this primary in again, and this could set back the general election weeks or a couple of months, which you could do. I mean, look, the city and the people and the candidates, they'll all be fine. They're adults. You know, we can figure all this out. But again, is it worth it at this point? Or should the concentration simply be to get the court proceedings right? Right? Just a thought. I don't know. I mean, you could, you know, again, you can do this. You can redo the primary. And, you know, what if the primary results come out to be, you know, essentially the same thing, essentially. But maybe you do this for the common good. I don't know. Dorothy, what's up with you today? Hi.
Hi. I would like to go to the general election. I'm glad they're all on the ballot, okay? They're all on the ballot. Mm-hmm. I want to go to the general election, and I want, what you said before, the court procedures to go ahead. I just want to.
So you don't
I want
see
a chance to vote.
Yeah.
And I want everybody to vote, everyone. Please, God, let's hope twice or three times the people who stayed home.
Yeah.
Please, please. And I know now there some of them are working, but all the people my age and whatever age, come on, let's just vote.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's going to be observing. There won't be any stuffing of the ballots. And I think we'll
have. You hope.
Well, yeah, I have to hope. I have to hope. I'm the girl who was in the suburbs,
yeah.
Only crossed Park Avenue,
yeah.
Because I didn't want to spend $300,000 for a condo. I spent $60,000. The taxes were $4,000 compared to my beautiful house on a cul-de-sac near Sacred now I'm near Sacred Heart.
Mm-hmm.
Before I was near Fairfield U, taxes $2,700.
Yeah.
Cross Park Avenue,
but
a 700 square foot condo,
yeah.
Like a lot of divorcees, a lot
yeah.
of widows,
yeah.
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I am disgusted.
Yeah.
Because I did help 4 years ago, and my voice was repeated over. I was hoarse. And he says to me, everybody's telling me how great you are, blah, blah, blah. And I said, all you had to do was record my voice, press a button, and 500 people could have heard me.
There you go.
But now I'm disgusted.
Yeah.
I am, because you know what? Maybe I was naive. I had people tell me. I had a neighbor call me.
Yeah.
He says, I know you don't have any clue where you are, what you're doing.
Yeah.
You're just a good, honest.
Yeah.
Well, I am honest. I'm not ashamed to say I'm honest.
No, it's all right.
And I have scruples. And I know the difference between right and wrong.
All right.
And I know with an absentee ballot, you hand it to me or to somebody else because
yep.
I had knee surgery years ago.
And Dottie,
and
I'm sorry.
Nobody touched that ballot.
I do have to run. Thanks, Dottie. Appreciate it. I want to squeeze Mike in here. Mike in Milford. Mike, what's up, sir?
Hey, Paul. I had a question. If the judge rules that there should be a new primary and Gomes wins the primary, is Ganim still on the ballot?
If Gomes wins the primary, then he's the Democratic nominee, so Mr. Ganim would have to pursue another line on that ballot. So he could probably get on. Yeah, I would think
okay,
so.
Okay, okay.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's not automatic. So when you're saying they're both on the ballot, well, it could make a difference. And obviously, being the Democratic nominee makes a tremendous difference as opposed to being an independent or a third-party candidate.
Yes, and Mike, thank you. You're breaking up a little bit. But, yeah, you always want to be, and thank you, Mike. You were choppy there a little. You always want to be the party nominee. Yeah, but I would assume if they did a redo on the primary, then, Maybe the Mr. Ganim would be able to capture one of those other lines. All right, we'll get back to open phones in just a bit. Coming up, more news about state taxpayer money being used to bolster the Excel Center in Hartford. That's kind of been turning into this used car that you don't want to trade in. You just keep pumping money into. Going to join our buddy Chris Caruso right now, who normally joins us in the 5 o'clock hour, but he'll be busy emceeing the big dinner tonight before the band concerts at the Klein heading into Columbus Day weekend. Chris, it's Paul here. Good afternoon. How are you?
Paul, how are you doing today?
I'm good. And Chris, I want to get your opinion on the, you know, what stage we are here in the ballot investigation. I mean, we had stories this week of, you know, the ballots being swabbed for DNA and saliva and fingerprints. Yeah. And so I guess it sounds to me, Chris, and what do I know? This is still a serious investigation. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think it is, Paul. I don't think this can be swept under the rug. I don't think it can be ignored. I don't think it be placated. I think it has to be acted on. And they're taking the investigation very seriously. I just heard the other day from a couple of reliable sources that the FBI is now involved, too.
Mm.
So this could reach federal offenses as well. And, you know, when they start taking fingerprints from the ballots and saliva tests and so forth, it sounds pretty serious. And it should be. You know, this is the ballot, you know.
Yeah, and Chris, you know, we have video round two here. So now it seems to be, and again, we are into the innocent till proven guilty mode here, but it certainly
sure
does seem to be that this involves, at least if you're facing off Ganim v. Gomes, it appears to be both camps are involved here.
Oh, yeah, I kind of expected it, Paul. You know, when it first came out, you know, everyone was pointing their finger at one particular camp, but I believe it involves everyone. And it just shows the depth of the problem and the corruption involved. What's happened is over the years, people have been trained or taught, frankly, how to steal absentee ballots, how to, you know, take the ballots and put them into the ballot boxes. And I've called it an art form because that's what it's been. And it shows how deep it's run. You know, the mentors in the political system aren't teaching the workers how to do things legitimately and correctly. What's happening is now become, you know, vote harvesting and, you know, banking the ballots before the election. And so it's very serious. It's widespread. It's deep. And it needs to be uprooted. And there people need to go to jail. That's basically what's going to happen.
Yeah. And my fear on this, Chris, though, however, is that some of the powers that be in Hartford, and they're already kind of alluding to this, well, let's not go crazy here. Let's not do anything punitive. We'll
sure
figure out the Bridgeport situation. But, you know, Chris, to me, when I hear, well, it's only Bridgeport, or even if it's only one or two or three municipalities, that's very, to me, that's standoffish. Like, hey, it's only these cities, so let's not subject other people to more stringent guidelines. Frankly, Chris, I don't understand the logic in that. I just don't.
Well, it's a fallacy, Paul, because as I've mentioned to you, when I chaired the GAE committee in Hartford, there was absentee ballot abuse occurring throughout the state of Connecticut. It wasn't just in the cities. There were smaller towns, suburban towns, rural communities, all where absentee ballot abuse was happening. So if those elected officials just want to turn their head and pretend it's just a city and it's just Bridgeport, it's foolish. And frankly, it's outright incorrect because it's happening throughout the state of Connecticut. It needs to be addressed. You know, and so what are we going to say? Okay, well, it's happening in one city, so we'll correct that problem. But when it happens in another, we're going to do this piecemeal approach. This is the sanctity of the ballot, the sacredness of the ballot, and it affects every citizen in this state and country. It's a fundamental right of a democracy, of people being able to vote for who their representatives are going to be. And the voter needs to have the confidence and the trust that the ballot is being respected and that there's an objective review that takes place and there's a security of the ballot. In these particular cases, none of that exists. So, you know, Hartford often does that, you know, points a finger at one particular town because that's an easy way to address a problem, but it's not the right way. There's widespread corruption around the ballots, and we've got to weed that out, and we've got to do it across the state. You know, if someone's robbing something in Bridgeport, a ballot, and they go and rob it in let's say Canton, Connecticut, or you know Torrington, or whatever other town you want to pick, they all should be treated equally. There should be jail time and punishment for it.
And Chris, finally, now that we, in a sense, we don't have mail-in voting per se, but we kind of do because we have no excuse absentee balloting, and people will be able to say, well, I want an absentee because I'm just afraid of getting sick. And the other thing I hope here, Chris, and is that Connecticut in some way, shape, or form can follow up with one of the with what other states have done who do have mail-in voting, and they went ahead and did it, but they waited 4, 5, 6 years, some of these western states did, to come up with very strict security issues vis-a-vis signature verification and double and triple checking lists, which, Chris, maybe you're hearing things that I'm not, but I don't hear any of that at all being discussed here in Connecticut. I just don't.
No, and I think you're right, Paul, and I think there needs to be review, and those questions need to be answered. There needs to be security involved. There's no question about it, and it's to the extent. You don't want to prohibit a person's right to vote or hinder their right to vote, but you want to make it safe and you want to make it secure so, again, that the public has trust in the system. If the public doesn't have trust in the system, they're not going to vote. They're going to feel, well, why does my vote count? Why should I even bother? And they won't go to the polls. So, no, I think it's important that we try to make voting accessible to people, but also with safeguards so that the sanctity, the respect of the ballot is maintained at all times. I would agree with you, Paul, and I think it's going to take the people of this state to demand change. And it's through their elected officials to make the calls, to write the emails, to demand change, and then work with advocacy groups in Hartford to make sure that happens. That's how we got public financing through. That's how we did reforms on ethics commission and various laws was a public outcry that demanded the change.
Chris, thank you. Have a wonderful weekend. Yes. Good luck tonight. Yes. Tonight and tomorrow with the band concerts and the parades and everything. And if people throw money at you, Chris, just make sure you declare it. That's all.
I'll throw it back, Paul. Yeah. I'll throw it back.
Or you give it to Amaron there for the second collection. There you go, right?
That's right.
All right, Chris.
Have a good weekend, Paul. Happy Columbus Day.
You too, buddy. Happy Columbus Day. Yeah, there you go. Oh, man. All right. He's right. He's right, but some members of his party aren't really into it. And again, folks, I'm not making this up. I mean, we heard some leaders of the Democratic Party, the majority there. And let's face it, people say, well, you're always talking about the Democrats. Well, they're in control. Now, is that the Republican Party's fault that they can't get more people elected? To a point, yeah, maybe. But it already came out from, you know, and I'm remembering as best I can, but it already came out from Bob Duff and Martin Looney and some other Democrats saying, hey, you know, this is not a problem in every city or town. Well, that's good. It shouldn't be a problem in every city or town. So I think for the areas it continues to be a problem, a.k.a. Bridgeport, and I'm sure some Democrats would agree with this, independent voters would agree with this, let's set it up so the penalties are so punitive, and some would say draconian. Well, sometimes you need draconian stuff, right? You set it up to you say, okay, because of this, it's good. Because of the alleged stuff that went on, and it's going on in Bridgeport, and the proven stuff that went on in Stamford a few years ago, and I think there was an incident or two in West Haven and other city towns. You know, as JFK used to say, you let the word go forth, you know? You say, listen, we're done playing around with the absentee ballot funny business. This is what it is. Don't even think of doing this or you will end up in jail. Now, you won't go to jail for life, but it'll be embarrassing if you go to jail for 6 months. Because, again, this is only you need a complete top to bottom review. And I don't care whether it, you know, Connecticut's got 169 cities and towns. I don't care if the only cities and towns are Bridgeport and Stamford and the other 167 are pure as the driven snow. But you've got to set up measures after this thing, whatever happened and did happen and may have happened in Bridgeport, is all hashed out. And you say, okay, now, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you, whatever. Or fool me, however that goes. You know the one I'm talking about. And you just say, okay, we've gotten together, and these will be the penalties. Now, I know what some people are going to say. Say, well, if somebody knowingly commits an absentee ballot mistake, well, then you delineate that. If somebody makes an honest mistake, there can be exceptions for that. There can. But if you tie someone to do this, to doing this on somewhat of a magnified scale, and that person is then tied by fact to one of the campaigns or a campaign or a major party or candidate, then you have to drop the hammer. Well, I don't think I should go to jail for 6 months for just playing around with 15 or 20 absentee ballots. Well, what you don't think might, I got news for you, Clyde. It may not matter. And lest you think that people like myself and Chris Caruso are making a big deal out of this, no, you have to understand something. We have the use of absentee ballots in this state is going to continue, and it's going to get bigger because we now have no excuse absentee ballots. We don't have mail-in voting in this state per se entitled, but we have a system now where all you have to say is, I want an absentee. Why do you want an absentee ballot? Because I'm simply afraid I might get sick. That's essentially mail-in voting. And it is incumbent upon the people that rule us in Hartford to say, okay, we've got to make the safety measures here the best and the tightest they can be. And never mind with this garbage of, oh, you're going to disenfranchise somebody and they can't vote. That's garbage. That's nonsense. You know what elections are. They don't sneak up on you. Do some planning. All right, we're 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Once again, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Want to get an update here on a couple things that we've been talking about, the Bridgeport absentee ballot situation, of course, and a concern that I've chatted about here on the show numerous times over the past couple of months, heating assistance for people who are going to have trouble staying warm in the winter months. And State Senate Republican Leader Kevin Kelly is here to jump on both of those. Kevin, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. I'm pretty good. Yourself?
I'm good, Kevin. I'm good. Always good to have you here. A couple things. Let's talk about first the absentee ballot situation. And I know, Kevin, now the next step in the phase is done with this whole thing. Apparently, they took DNA evidence as much as they could from these ballots. The state says it's handed over the materials to both sides in court. We have the video that's out there that seems to shed light, Kevin, on both sides. But I was a little distressed a few days ago to hear from some leaders in Hartford who are pretty much in the, hey, let's not overreact to this whole thing. And it's almost like, Kevin, to me, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, correct me if you think I'm wrong, it's almost like they're trying to set the stage here for, like, hey, it's only Bridgeport. What do you expect? That doesn't sound too good to me.
Well, that's exactly what they're saying, Paul. They're not trying to skirt the issue. As a matter of fact, when we had the bill in the special session, the election monitor was limited to communities of 140,000 or more, which means only Bridgeport. And to me, as a legislator from the greater Bridgeport area, I didn't like that at all. I was like, that is just not fair to Bridgeport to single it out when in Stamford, the Democratic town chairman down there was last year convicted after 6 years of absentee ballot fraud. You know, the majority in Hartford, which are the status quo establishment Democrats, are trying to make this out to be only a Bridgeport thing when we have, the history is replete. I think I looked it up the other day in the since 2010 that I went to Hartford, there's been like 13 or 14 communities across the state of Connecticut, both small town and large cities, where absentee ballot abuses have been alleged and you've ended up with a fine, an infraction, or a conviction. And to limit it to Bridgeport, and then also when Republicans come up and talk about let's get rid of the drop box. Obviously, they're an attractive nuisance to these campaigns because you see not one video, but you see multiple videos of the same conduct happening. Well, they're like, oh, those extreme Republicans go. Well, let's remind the listeners, the Democrats are disclosing these videos. It's the Democrats, the challenge Democrats to the status quo that are saying there's abuse going on. And so now it's not just Republicans. It's anybody who is opposed to the status quo gets treated the same way. And that's not what people expect in this country. And that's not what elections are about. And you know what? Connecticut can do better, and we must. And we can't wait till next year. I'd like to see something happen now. But like that instance in Stanford shows, it took 6 years to get a conviction. A person engaged in fraudulent absentee ballot corruption, and they get a slap on the wrist, they get an extended sentence and a fine. And Paul, quite frankly, what we need to do is have a mandatory minimum jail time. Somebody does this, they go to jail. Can't plea bargain, you're going to go to jail because our democracy, our government is that important. Because when everyone is guaranteed by our Constitution, one vote, one person. And when someone goes to the ballot box and puts more ballots in and gets to vote multiple times, well, guess what? That's voter suppression for the rest of us. And that takes our freedom of choice away as to what type of government we want. And if we lose our freedom of choice, they should also lose their freedom.
You know, Kevin, there's nothing wrong with, and I know we don't want to be draconian here, but there's nothing wrong with instilling a little fear in people that, you know, who have a notion to do this, where they may say, hey, maybe this isn't the best thing I want to do here. Because, you know, Kevin, there's that old phrase, fear is life's greatest motivator. Is it not sometimes?
Well, I believe it is. And obviously, the remedy that we have available to us doesn't work because it took 6 years. But, Paul, we also need to step back and take a look at what this is all about. We're trying to create integrity in the system so that the people have trust, faith, and confidence in the electoral outcomes, that whoever is elected is the winner. And that's what's sorely being eroded now. And, you know, we look at what the American flag stands for. It talks about democracy being that shining city on a hill, something everybody in the world aspires to, because what we have here in this country is great. And it's actually a Connecticut idea that was born here. If we're going to make sure it's sacred and protected, it needs to happen here. And so we shouldn't be thinking, oh, you know, should we be draconian? No, as a matter of fact, you know, you look at what our veterans do for the American flag and for democracy and what it means across the world. Well, we need to stand up for it here in our country and to make sure that the vote is protected. And that's what we need to do here in Connecticut right now, because the video, you know, as Warner Wolf would always say, you know, go to the video. Don't have the argument. Just go to the video. It'll tell you what's happening. Well, we have it. And yet there's still the status quo majority wants to put their head in the sand saying, it's just the in Bridgeport, or it's just a handful, or it's because the electorate is undereducated, or there those Republicans go again. There's an excuse rather than looking at, you know what, let's have pride in our democracy. Let's fight for something. Let's fight to make sure that the people's will is heard. And to me, there's nothing more important than that.
Kevin, briefly, in the couple of minutes we have left, sad news that our friends at Operation Fuel have already said that they have to stop early taking applications for fuel assistance this year because they've been so overwhelmed, and we're not even into, you know, the middle of October yet. It's not really cold out there. I know you and some folks in the General Assembly have been very vocal about this. pleading with the governor and with the majority there to figure something out, whether it's more state funding, which we have, whether it's federal funding. But I don't quite understand, Kevin, with the money we have, especially in the rainy day fund, and I understand there are legal limits on that, but to have these people saying, hey, at least at this point, we cannot help as many people as we'd like to, at least at this point.
Yeah, well, Paul, you know, this is not my mom's Democratic Party anymore. It's a new breed. And you see what's going on here, because Washington has made a cut in these funds so that the benefits from just 2 years ago have been cut 72%. And that's, you know, a tremendous cut. We have now greater demand because of the economy isn't working for all the people. And you have additional increases in the cost of energy, that there's more impact on families, and there's more families living hand to mouth, paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. So while Washington isn't doing what it should, and quite frankly, Washington is dysfunctional. Anybody that believes that they should be doing it for us, I don't know where they get that idea. But these aren't, you know, strangers. These are our neighbors. These are our people that live in our communities. And as a Connecticut legislator, we need to take care of Connecticut families. That's what Connecticut leaders do. That's why we want to fix this. And keep in mind, Paul, that this week, while, you know, the Democrats are cutting aid to disabled individuals, seniors on fixed income, and poor kids, we're depositing $1.8 billion to pay down debt. Mm-hmm. Now, I know debt is important. We can't continue to carry that. But when you look at, are people going to go cold, and we see that we're going to have more snow this year from AccuWeather forecasts, that how can you do that? We can't afford to have a wait-and-see attitude when human beings are in the balance. And I just find it hard. I think it's a cold, callous policy to turn a blind eye to these families. But basically, that's what the majority is offering. Their response is, you know, humbug, you know, tough on them. And I think, you know, Connecticut not only must do better, but we can do better. Right. We have the ability, and we need to do that.
Well, Kevin, keep the pressure up there, and maybe we can prize some of this rainy day fund money out there, a few million bucks at least, to help keep people warm. Kevin, thank you. We appreciate it. Have a good weekend, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
You bet. Take care.
All right. Thanks, Kevin. There you go. And listen, I know there's procedural issues here, and I know there's issues about what money can be used for what. But again, Kevin's been one of the loudest advocates on this. On the Republican side of the aisle, we learned the other day that the folks at Operation Fuel, it's a, you know, well-known charitable organization, OpFuel, saying, hey, we have to stop taking fuel assistance applications early because we're facing a bigger-than-ever demand, and we're also facing, at this point, a lack of funding here. And yes, I know OpFuel is a private, it's a charity, I get it, and it's not under a state umbrella. But again, you know, you would think with all the fine people, the 36 people in the General Assembly and the 151 people in the State House and the people in the governor's office and the executive branch there, I think we can figure something out. In fact, Sean Scanlon, again, the state comptroller, talking about the money we have in the black today, how big by law the rainy day fund is. It can't get any bigger. There's a statutory limit on how much we can have in there. So all we got to do is figure out how to keep people warm. There we go. Ah, yes. And, you know, it's time to go to political history class right now. As we'll get back to open phones later on, we love to have our authors on to bring us new perspectives on stuff that maybe you and I have lived through. Now, back in 1968, I wasn't that wary of politics back then. I was wearing feety pajamas and watching cartoons and eating cereal. But I soon became politically aware in years after that, and always look back at certain elections and the effect they had on the country. And a lot of you folks who are my age or maybe even a lot older remember 1968 for everything that was going on in the streets and a very interesting presidential race. The name of the book is The Year That Broke Politics, Collusion, and Chaos. in the presidential election of 1968. Luke Nichter is the author. Luke, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good, Luke, and I have gone back and read so much about this election and go on YouTube when I get my nerd hat on and watch all the coverage of this. But, Luke, 1968 set the stage for us that eventually led to the election of Richard Nixon. But what led up to this?
Well, the nation was divided. The world was divided. The two major political parties were divided. We had unrest on our streets at home. We had the nation's longest war in Southeast Asia at the time, with 500,000 troops stationed there. It seemed like nothing was going right for the political establishment. And in the midst of that, you have the sitting president, Lyndon Johnson, who decides not to run, I think much more for health reasons than we realized. Mm-hmm. And I think when you look back at this, not just one of the most important elections in modern U.S. history, but I think there's so many parallels today without even trying very hard. Just this past week, with Robert Kennedy organizing a campaign, more and more people wondering whether President Biden has it in him to run it again. And 68 is not a perfect guide, but I think it's really the closest guide we have.
Yeah, and here you had Richard Nixon coming back, whose life, his political life anyway, people were saying, well, Nixon's done. He had lost a few years earlier to JFK. So here you had Richard Nixon, Mr. Button Down, rarely without a tie, always had his shine shoes and his slacks. You could never see Nixon in jeans. So he was this silent majority guy trying to push back, right? And then the Vietnam War, but had this racial unrest that he was facing as a nominee.
Well, that's right. You set it up nicely. I think Nixon had to convince people that he wasn't a loser after losing to John F. Kennedy in 1960 and then losing the California governorship more decisively in 1962. You know, his assistant, Pat Buchanan, said even Nixon thought he was a loser at that point. And I think ultimately people pulled the lever for Richard Nixon because he wasn't tied to the chaos of that decade. His career, really his rise, was the 1950s as vice president under Eisenhower for 8 years. And I think ultimately people voted the way they did because they just wanted to turn the noise level down on both sides, and voting for Nixon was a way to do that.
You talk about in the title of the book, collusion and chaos. The chaos was easy to see. We can go back and watch it. What's the collusion part of all this, Luke?
Well, the collusion refers to, and for those, when you look at the cover image of the book, what it looks like is sort of a silhouette effect where you see the famous outline of Lyndon Johnson talking to the famous outline of Richard Nixon in the Oval Office, a meeting they had shortly after the 1968 election. And the collusion is that this completely surprised me when doing the research. In the midst of it, the Reverend Billy Graham died at age 99 in February 2018. And his diary is beginning to be opened for research, a process that continues today. Mm-hmm. And there's a chapter in the book called Messenger, and it's called that because that's what Graham was doing in 1968, passing messages back and forth between Johnson and Nixon and the others. And ultimately, one of these messages was a multi-point promise by Nixon that as president, he would give Johnson credit for Vietnam, consult with him in retirement, do everything he could do to give LBJ a good place in history. And this is just incredible when I discovered this. Nixon told Johnson, this is before the election, exactly what he needed to hear at a time when many in Johnson's own party were very critical of him.
Wow, that, Luke Nichter, is just another aspect. As you take a look at Richard Nixon himself, separate from this, what a contrast in perception of him and his own demons that brought him down and his paranoia. But yet what you said, just contrast that and the image people have left of him versus how cerebral and deliberative of a guy he could be.
Well, and I'm not sure today with social media we could keep secrets like that. But it's stunning to me to think this meeting, this message was passed just after Labor Day of 68, nearly 3 months before people went to the polls. Nixon at that point has handed Johnson all the ammunition to blow up Nixon's campaign in case he doesn't like this idea very much. But he didn't do that, which leads me to believe that he went along with it.
Lee, in one of the enduring images, Luke, and the guest is Luke Nichter, the book The Year That Broke Politics, Collusion and Chaos in the Presidential Election of 1968. You know, I told somebody at the station here I was having you on, and they're a bit younger, and I said, hey, when you get a chance, go on YouTube, God bless the great God YouTube, and pull up the CBS News coverage of the 68 convention, Luke, when you had guys, network news correspondents, getting roughed up in Chicago on the floor of the convention. I mean, Luke, people think it's crazy today. I say, no. Go back and look at this stuff. It's a fascinating thing to look at.
I think one of the, you know, there are a lot of parallels, and not all of them work exactly with our own era. But one of them I think that's becoming very important now, looking ahead to next year's election, is so many people no longer have faith or trust in the nation's institutions, whether that be mainstream media, whether that be the political parties themselves, organized religion, government. And I think when that happens, you see those images you're describing in 1968 of police taking part in violence in Chicago, you know, against media in some cases. And one more parallel, which doesn't take a whole lot of effort to figure out, the Democrats are going back to Chicago next year with their convention. So I hope we don't see that again.
Is this just part of the pendulum of American politics, Luke Nichter? We go back and forth and we swing far left and far right, and there are angry years and good years and everybody is happy years, and oh, we have to be angry at each other again because this is boring. Is this the pendulous quality of American politics?
Well, I like that term, pendulum. I use it in class sometimes when I teach undergraduates. I think the pendulum in politics is it never stands still. We can't always see it because we're living in the moment, and it takes perspective and sort of professional distance from it. But the pendulum's always moving. It's moving right now, even if we can't tell exactly where it's going or why it's going there or the speed it's going there. But I think you're exactly right. With the, I think a lot of it's the cycles of government. When you term limit a president, your four-year terms or an eight-year term, people are fickle and they get tired of one party after a while, and then they vote. They throw the bums out and vote someone in who, in another era, might have not had a chance to get voted in. So I think it shows the pendulum's always in movement, as you say.
Was this a moment, Luke, 1968, you say it broke politics. Did the 68 campaign hurt us in the long term, even though, as you say, it wasn't nearly acrimonious on the inside? But what kind of lasting effects are we still seeing, Luke, from the 68 campaign?
Oh, I think certainly faith in institutions is one that I touched on. I think another one that's fascinating that we haven't mentioned so far is the third party race in 1968 of former Alabama, future Alabama Governor George Wallace, and the effect of a third party candidate on the two major parties, which we're about to see potentially with an announcement in the next day or two by Robert Kennedy Jr. And I think if you're Kennedy or working for him, you really need to study up on the playbook of Wallace in 68, what it takes to get on the ballot in all 50 states, which party does the third party candidate draw and drain more support away from, the role of the blue-collar voters. The last Democrat to win them as a voting bloc was Lyndon Johnson in 1964. And so this is, again, another fascinating parallel, the chance for a third-party candidate who probably has no real chance to win overall but has real potential to cause their own kind of chaos and collusion and possibly even deny an election to one of the major party candidates.
So we've talked about Bobby Kennedy and Hubert and check that, and George Wallace and Richard Nixon and LBJ, but one of the forgotten guys that I have not brought up to you yet, and I'm sure it's in the book, Hubert Humphrey, who was the Democratic candidate that year, and he made a pretty gutsy speech during that whole thing, didn't he?
He did. So Hubert Humphrey, I will set it up because I was born in the late 70s, so I'm not living through this. I have to remember sometimes what happened during an election. Mm-hmm. But Hubert Humphrey was then the sitting vice president, who was getting ready to run for re-election as Lyndon Johnson's vice presidential ticket mate that year, and all of a sudden Johnson withdraws from the race on March 31st, 1968. And through a series of events, Humphrey is in the best position. We haven't talked about the assassinations of Dr. Martin Luther King and then Senator Robert Kennedy in April and then June, effectively making Humphrey, coronating him the nominee because he has no real challenger anymore at that point. And Humphrey, he's the one I feel the most for in this book because he never really had a chance to start his campaign for those reasons. It kept getting interrupted for all kinds of reasons. But he was tied to a lot of the war, even though he'd been a peace candidate for years and been anti-war earlier in his career. I think Humphrey was an incredibly decent person, maybe too decent even for politics, and he made it close. We used to say one of the closest elections in U.S. history, about 500,000 votes. Of course, they're all close now since 2000, Bush-Gore. And a lot of times even the winner ends up losing the popular vote. So that closeness aspect, that's dulled a little bit in our memory. But Humphrey made it awfully close when he tried to separate himself from Johnson over the issue of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Luke, good luck with this. Luke Nichter has been the guest, author, college instructor as well. The Year That Broke Politics, Collusion and Chaos in the Presidential Election of 1968. Luke, hopefully we can chat in the future. Good luck and take care.
I'd love to. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Luke. Appreciate it. Yeah, you folks who lived through it, I know I have a lot of listeners there. It's why I wanted to have Luke Nichter on. I got pitched this book, and I said, absolutely. The Year That Broke Politics, Collusion and Chaos in the Presidential Election of 1968. And again, the little tidbits he brings out there. I mean, who knew that the Reverend Billy Graham in that election was a kind of a shuttle diplomat between LBJ's camp and Richard Nixon's camp? And Nixon, as caustic as we remember him, what did Luke say? Promising that LBJ would have a prominent part in history going forward. Interesting. The stuff you still find out. We think we know it all. We don't. We don't know not half of it. We don't know one smidgen of it.